This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Linda Mottram. In this episode, the Hawke legacy on this final day of the election campaign. What did he do in foreign affairs and what's the lesson from his consensus style? And Rugby Australia's landmark decision to axe Israel Folau. Welcome to PM, to the last day of the election campaign and remembering Bob Hawke in a moment. But first, former Wallabies star Israel Folau says he's considering his options after Rugby Australia's decision today to terminate his multi-million dollar contract. An independent panel earlier ruled the devout Christian's posting of hurtful comments about homosexuals on his social media accounts amounted to a high-level breach of the sport's code of conduct. Rugby Australia acknowledges its decision will be regarded as a landmark in sports management worldwide. Samantha Donovan reports.
After standing down Israel Folau last month, Rugby Australia today decided his social media posts warrant the termination of his contract. Rugby Australia CEO Raylene Castle says it's a painful situation.
Rugby Australia did not choose to be in this situation, but Rugby Australia's position remains that Israel, through his actions, left us with no choice but to pursue the course of action resulting in today's outcome. But our clear message to all rugby fans today is that we need to stand by our values and the qualities of inclusion, passion, integrity, discipline, respect and teamwork.
Ms Castle says all of Rugby Australia's professional players have been contacted.
To make it clear that Rugby Australia fully supports their right to their own beliefs and nothing that has happened changes that. But when we are talking about inclusiveness in our game, we're talking about respecting differences as well. When we say rugby is a game for all, we mean it. People need to feel safe and welcomed in our game, regardless of their gender, race, background, religion or sexuality.
Israel Folau has released a statement expressing his sadness at the decision and confirming he's considering his options, though he gives no hint of what they may be. His statement continues...
It has been a privilege and an honour to represent Australia and my home state of New South Wales, playing the game I love. As Australians, we are born with certain rights, including the right to freedom of religion and the right to freedom of expression. The Christian faith has always been a part of my life, and I believe it is my duty as a Christian to share God's word. Upholding my religious beliefs should not prevent my ability to work or play for my club and country.
Lawyer Catherine Ordway is an assistant professor of sports management at the University of Canberra. She believes Rugby Australia has gone too far by sacking Folau.
I think I'm disappointed that they've used such a blunt instrument, because I think the termination of a contract is a very serious matter, particularly when you're dealing with an athlete's career that is very short. It's also very serious from their side, because it's not as though you can go to the supermarket and pick up another player of his calibre. In a way, I suppose, they were comparing it to a situation off-field where the impact that you have is in relation to one person, whether we're talking about family violence or violence in the community, in a pub or something like that, where in this case, Israel's profile is so enormous that he impacts hundreds of thousands of people, and it has led to hurt and pain in the community much more broadly than I think he appreciates.
What other options would you like to have seen Rugby Australia use to resolve the situation?
I think a suspension might have been more appropriate. If they'd exercised some flexibility around a suspension, there might have been an opportunity to save the relationship. But they've obviously decided there's no way that they can.
Catherine Ordway agrees with Rugby Australia's view that its decision to terminate Folau's contract is a landmark in sports management worldwide.
Not just for rugby in Australia and rugby internationally, but also for other sports. Any of the players' unions around the world would be looking at this decision and saying, we need to have a think about this and what impact this has on future collective bargaining agreements and future arrangements that we make with athletes, both in a team setting and for those individual athletes.
Rugby Australia wouldn't comment on reports Folau intends to appeal its decision in the Supreme Court of New South Wales.
Samantha Donovan with that report. Well, Bob Hawke's political timing was impeccable right to the end, his death coming just hours out from the federal election, in which some pundits expect a victory for his beloved Labor Party. The sweep of his contribution is evident all around the nation and the world today, with tributes gushing in. Hawke was a complicated man. He had a genuine public love affair with the Australian people, and behind the scenes, affairs of a very different nature. But one of his most enduring legacies, and to many the most surprising as he took up the mantle of power in 1983, was his ability as a world statesman. Political reporter Tom Eagledon takes a look.
He was the folk hero Prime Minister, the reciprocal affection between the leader and his people, arguably without equal in Australian politics. A schoolgirl summed it up during one of Mr Hawke's school visits as Prime Minister.
One prep child was so excited he became a little mixed up and told his mother that God was coming on
television. No Prime Minister, before or since, harnessed the power of television quite like Mr Hawke. He even presented awards at the Logies.
The winner is Bert Newton.
His wit was quick and his humour self-deprecating.
Bert, it's not often I yield a platform to a bloke to make a speech, but I think it's your turn, mate.
Despite giving up the booze upon entering politics, his colourful personal life remained a source of political danger and a strain on his marriage to first wife Hazel Hawke.
Would you have been happy to extend to Hazel the same sexual freedom as you were able to enjoy?
No. Pass that one.
Channel 10 Chief of Staff Tim Sweeney travelled as a cameraman on Mr Hawke's overseas visits for the duration of his time as Prime Minister. He says Mr Hawke's reputation now as a statesman was not something expected of him as he took power.
There was a lot of speculation as to whether, you know, his bodgy past would, silver bodgy past, would, for example, Margaret Thatcher, would that work?
But, says Tim Sweeney, his charm won the British Prime Minister over and Mr Hawke used the relationship for good at a Commonwealth Heads of Government conference in the Bahamas.
He was the one who really did set in train Nelson Mandela getting out, because he rolled Margaret. We were down in the Bahamas, and his, shall we say, diplomatic efforts with the Iron Maiden, it gave fruit, and eventually, because of that, Mandela got out of jail.
He was just as effective behind the Iron Curtain, taking up the case of over 100 imprisoned refuseniks when he met then Russian President Mikhail Gorbachev in Moscow after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
And literally the door's about to close, and we were told, and Bob broke down about this, that Gorbachev would in fact release these Russian refuseniks. They were Jewish people, and he cried in front of us, and that's something that happened a lot.
Bob Hawke was also the prime motivator behind the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC. It was born out of frustration with a US-European trade war that impacted on Australia's international trade. Here's how former US President George H.W. Bush remembered his dealings with Mr. Hawke.
I had some difficulty explaining to Australian friends that it wasn't aimed at them, because frankly it hurt Australia at times. And again on Bob Hawke, he'd lean on me. I mean, he'd say, wait a minute.
Australia and New Zealand have been immediately forthcoming with sending our resources immediately to them when they have been faced by the reality of war. Now they are imposing a trade war upon us.
Bob Hawke lost patience and, in South Korea some months later, proposed APEC and corralled support for it among 11 other Pacific Rim nations.
I believe that the time has come for us substantially to increase our efforts towards building regional cooperation and seriously to investigate what areas it might focus on and what forms it might take.
APEC remains a key plank for regional cooperation, and his relationship with Mr Bush also remains strong, so much so that Mr Hawke signed up Australia as one of the first countries in Mr Bush's coalition of the willing to take on Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War.
The world could wait no longer.
We cannot have peace just by wishing for it or just by talking about it.
Mr Hawke later remembered it was a tough decision for a Labor leader commanding a party built on pacifism.
We had this tradition of opposition to the war in Vietnam, and people were very, very worried about the concept of going to war again.
He also set a new course on China. First, he condemned the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre.
Personnel carriers and tanks moved in to push the remains into piles, which were then incinerated.
But despite the tears and admonition, he somehow managed to open up a new relationship with Beijing based on shared prosperity.
Australia and China must not be deterred from our shared goals.
The late Bob Hawke, Tom Eagledon with that report. Former Fraser government minister Fred Chaney says Bob Hawke was the leader for the times, and he says the lesson of the Hawke era is the value of more cooperation rather than competition between the major parties. A Liberal senator, then MP, Fred Chaney held several portfolios in the Fraser government, which preceded Bob Hawke's ascendancy. So when we spoke earlier, I asked first for his thoughts on why Australians trusted Bob Hawke.
I think they saw him as one of them. I mean, he defies any class definition. He was the sort of person who could deal with, captains, kings and the most down and out. I mean, he had that wonderful quality of being classless, in a sense, even though he was highly intelligent and highly accomplished.
From the other side of politics, where you were, what was your view at the time of Hawke's policy agenda, the Accord, floating the dollar, deregulating the banks, superannuation, Medicare? I could go on. What was your view at the time?
Well, I think, to be quite honest, the first year of the Hawke government was a bit of a surprise to everybody. I don't think that in the campaign, some of the extraordinary changes that were made were really forecast. But I think it became apparent very early that he was the leader for the times because, in my own opinion, I thought his bringing capital and labour together and the way he did was exactly what was required. The country was pretty divided. The country was pretty down. And I think he gave it a sense of optimism. And then his first budget made it absolutely clear that we weren't dealing with another Whitlam, but with a government that was really better at governing. And so I think the early impressions I got from the first years of his government were very positive indeed.
It wasn't just Hawke, of course. It was him, his ministers and the ACTU leader of the time, Bill Keelty, really crucial. Just how important were those other players?
Well, look, I think he had a highly talented ministry. I mean, I sat opposite John Button for 7 years in the Senate, and I mean, I greatly admired his capacity and his imagination and his work. But there were other very talented ministers in that house, including Gareth Evans. But overall, I think he had a very good ministry. But the great Hawke contribution was that he was able to use those talents and, you know, have a pretty harmonious government. I think he was very fortunate that Bill Keelty was leading the ACTU. I mean, again, that bringing capital and labour together, you know, was so important, I think, to getting those reforms through, and Bill Keelty was the ideal partner. It's perhaps also important to remember that it came at the end of a really turbulent sort of debate in Australia between what was my party's concern between wets and dries, and the notion of having a more open economy had been really argued and hard fought, and Hawke swept into power and actually started doing it.
What are the lessons from Hawke's approach for today's political leaders? Because presumably it wasn't just instinct. Presumably there was political calculation in his style as well.
Well, yes, I think he was a very, very clever politician, and it would be wrong to overemphasise the bipartisanship of the times because the 1975 had been extremely partisan, and of course politics can be pretty rough. But I think the lesson for me was that there's much more to be gained through cooperation. And I think one of the things we might learn from the Hawke period is that it would be a good idea if the major parties made the minor parties rather less relevant by being able to agree on where there are fundamental areas that require reform. As it is, we get the tail wagging the dog, and I don't think that was happening during that Hawke Parliament, and I like to think that the Liberal and National parties played their part in that.
Former Fraser government minister Fred Chaney. This is PM on radio, on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, mixing the arts and politics. What's at stake at this election for those with creative minds?
My name's Tamara Kohler. I'm a freelance flute player and I'm co-director of a new music ensemble based in Melbourne called Rubik's Collective. You talk to any artist in this country about the Brandis cuts and they'll know exactly what you're talking about.
Medicare is one of Bob Hawke's lasting legacies, and Labor put it front and centre today on the last day of its campaign. But where Labor is hopeful its health policies will win it votes tomorrow, the coalition has again focused on winning the support of first home buyers. For a look at the very final pitches to voters from both major parties, here's political reporter Stephanie Boris.
As TV crews and Labor politicians filled the hospital room of six-year-old Chase, he was all too happy to explain his injury.
I broke my arm.
Oh, you did? I can see that. How's it feeling?
Hurting.
It hurts a bit, does it?
Logan Hospital is in the marginal Queensland seat of Forde. It's held by the Liberal Party, but Deputy Labor Leader Tanya Plibersek is talking up the party's chances of winning the seat.
We're hopeful of a number of seats here in Queensland, but time will tell. We are very competitive in a number of seats.
Queensland has a number of marginal seats up for grabs, and the importance of the state in this campaign has been evident in how often the major parties have visited. Prime Minister Scott Morrison today dropping in on three marginal electorates.
This will be the closest election I think we've seen in many, many years. I mean, I don't think anyone who has been following me around the country for these last 5 weeks, 5 weeks ago, thought this is where the election would be the day before.
For Labor, they've used this campaign to focus on health and childcare. Speaking at Logan Hospital, Shadow Health Minister Catherine King paid tribute to former Prime Minister Bob Hawke, weaving his Medicare legacy into the final day of the election campaign.
Medicare is Bob's great legacy, and it's incumbent on all of us in the Labor Party to honour that legacy. And that's what we want to do tomorrow on election day. We want to invest in Medicare again. We know that for many people, out-of-pocket costs of healthcare have been growing under the Morrison government. We want to try and start to solve that problem.
Back in Sydney, opposition leader Bill Shorten spent the morning visiting Bob Hawke's widow.
Blanche said that nothing would make Bob happier than Labor forming a government tomorrow night. I think the time for talk about the election is nearly at an end, if it's not at an end. The voters will make their judgment now.
And with the end in sight, the major parties are doing their best to secure undecided voters. And the votes that really count in this election are the marginal seats scattered not just around Queensland, but also in Victoria and Western Australia. While Labor is pushing health, Prime Minister Scott Morrison believes there are votes to be won among first home buyers.
Where we're standing here today is in the heart of aspirational Australia, where we're seeing aspirations realised. We're seeing Australians' dreams of owning their first home being realised.
The death of Bob Hawke has created an unusual feel to the final day of campaigning before voters go to the polls. Nonetheless, there are messages the leaders hope will cut through.
A choice between a government that understands and appreciates and celebrates the aspirations of Australia, understands the champion within every Australian and wants to see that realised, or a Labor Party who knows they can't manage money and that's why they come after yours, why they raise your taxes.
I say vote for Labor for real change because it's in the interest of the people. I say that if we want to have the best Medicare system in the world, if we want to protect our environment and hand on a better environment to our kids and our grandkids, if we want to make sure that working people in this country get ahead again with help on cost of living and childcare.
More than 4 million people have already made up their mind and put pen to paper. The rest will head to the voting booths tomorrow, and the political parties are hoping for a clear result.
Stephanie Boris with that report. So have the final messages from the party leaders resonated with you? Well, research shows that if you are tribal, meaning you identify with a particular political team, it's very hard to sway your vote with just facts and figures. Dr. Frank Moles is a political psychologist at the University of Queensland. He says Bob Hawke understood that political appeal is about offering a shared sense of where the nation's going.
We tend to overrate rational cost-benefit evaluations. We could call it hip-pocket voting or pocketbook voting, as it's sometimes called. And time and again, researchers point to evidence suggesting that that's really not where the action is. To get people on board, there has to be an appeal to emotion, but also an appeal to shared social identity, a sense of us, we, this, our country or our group or our tribe. So politics is a lot about a tribal identification, if you want to use that word, or a more neutral word is social identification that determines what people do. And modern day research shows us very much that it's first and foremost a shared sense of identity that then mediates, that then filters what we see, including facts and evidence.
So looking at the current election campaign that we're just coming to the end of, what do you see? Do you see the parties understanding those principles in the way they've delivered their messaging?
Not necessarily. I think that politicians are in a way caught between a rock and a hard place as well. On the one hand, they have to show the audience, the voting public, that they're knowledgeable, that they have policy expertise. So they do have to address policy. They have to address costing. They do have to address technical issues around taxation, for example. But I think come election time, they continue in that kind of mode because that's how they argue in Parliament. That's what journalists will ask them about. They'll press them on these kinds of issues. So come election time, then there's a tendency for politicians to continue unthinkingly in that mode and deluding themselves, as it were, that the undecided or swinging voter is going to be persuaded by facts, evidence, logical arguments, and the evidence is simply not there to suggest that that's happening.
So what kind of identity could you successfully construct to win over the swinging voters in Australia in this day and age, when so much is about the economy, so much messaging about economic well-being?
So, of course, because we are used to team colours, there's the blue team, there's the red team, there's the green team, and the orange team, perhaps, we view evidence, facts, information through the lens of identity. And I can give you some examples if you want.
Well, I wonder if some of the examples are very starkly available for us in Trump's America.
Yes, correct. For us political psychologists, when Donald Trump said, "I can shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and people will still love me," I was not surprised by that because he's, in a sense, really right about that, right? Because once the tribal switch of Republican support is switched on and the motivating force is perhaps more even the hatred for the other party than support for your own candidate, then everything has to be filtered through that partisan identity. If you are confronting somebody who's incredibly partisan and that's the filter through which they view policy issues, then there is no amount of evidence that you can present them that will sway them in another direction. And this goes back to Aristotle's ideas about ethos, pathos, and logos. The trustworthiness of a message is important. The logic, the rational argument has to be sound, and it has to be seen to come from a trusted source. And it's precisely that trusted source that turns out to be the key factor. And what is a trusted source is somebody who we view as one of us.
So how do politicians win and lose elections then? Because if I believe that, you know, one colour is trusted source, the other isn't, what changes my mind?
Well, this is a bit ironic, I would say, because if you look at the mainstream parties here in Australia, and the story is, of course, the same elsewhere, parties use exactly the same technique. They still rely on these logical arguments and evidence and facts and hypocrite arguments, whilst the real persuasive power comes from an overarching sense of identity and a shared sense of mission. So leaders like Bob Hawke, why are they great and why are they remembered as great leaders? It's because they can unite people, they can offer them a shared social identity, in this case an Australian sense of pride and national trust and belief in the nation and where it's going.
And so between the two political leaders who are vying for the prime ministership in tomorrow's election, have either of them, in your view, successfully done what Bob Hawke did?
Personally, I don't think so. I think they're going very much with the same recipe from a political psychology perspective, that is. Ironically, it's often populist leaders who intuitively understand far better how to get people on board with the new mission, have this kind of knack for identity politics, have this kind of ability, also perhaps because they don't have to worry too much about the detail of the policy. Often they have very little in the way of policy. Of course, Clive Palmer's campaign tries to do that, and we'll see whether that's a success recipe or not.
Frank Moles, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Frank Moles from the University of Queensland. So what arts policies have the major parties unveiled during the election campaign? The question has been asked as part of the ABC's You Ask, We Answer initiative, where we assign a reporter to find the answers to your questions. On the arts, the Liberal Party has not delivered an arts policy for the election, though Labor has. Australian artists are concerned political neglect can erode our ability to tell our own stories. Reporter Sarah White investigated.
My name's Tamara Kohler. I'm a freelance flute player and I'm co-director of a new music ensemble based in Melbourne called Rubik's Collective. love to play music that is still wet on the ink is still wet on the page.
For 3 years, Tamara Kohler and her quartet have been relying heavily on federal arts grants to survive.
So I apply for grants probably, I'd say we probably put in for grants anywhere up to 2 to 3 times a month.
That's why she's been paying close attention to this federal election and what the major parties are offering to the arts. The Labor Party released its arts policy last weekend, giving $8 million to an Indigenous theatre company and $20 million to a live music fund to support live music in hotels, restaurants, cafes and festivals. It's also promising more than $100 million to the Australia Council that offers grants to groups like Rubix. The funding package has been pretty well received by the industry, but some of the criticism focused on a lack of quotas for Australian content on subscription services like Netflix.
Hello, Sydney Festival. Wesley speaking.
Wesley Enoch is a playwright and the artistic director of the Sydney Festival.
We've been looking at.
Of all the parties, who do you think has the strongest arts policy in this election?
That's very clear. It's actually about who's articulating an arts policy, and Labor has the strongest arts policy there. That's without even thinking about it.
Wesley Enoch says this because the Liberal Party doesn't have an election policy for the arts. Instead, a Liberal Party spokesman directed me to the most recent budget, where the government offered several funding initiatives for the arts, including $30 million for live music.
The Liberals have, if you like, they. And I know how this works, that most politicians don't think there are votes in the arts, so we don't have to articulate a vision, whereas I think actually quite the opposite.
In 2015, the arts world was rocked when then-Attorney General George Brandis cut more than $100 million from the Australia Council.
These kind of cuts are not just a I've lost my livelihood kind of thing. The whole industry, whether it's funded already or not, feels like at any time governments can just swipe us off to the side and forget about us.
He says the cuts, which were later partially restored by the coalition, went deeper than just money.
Well, the arts are in fact a manifestation of the creativity of a nation. And in many ways, the arts reflect back to a society, our aspirations and how we think about ourselves, how our identity is formed. And so for me, if you don't fund the arts, if you don't look after the arts, the storytelling of your whole nation starts to deteriorate.
Flautist Tamara Kohler agrees, but says even without new funding, artists will always push on.
I don't doubt that there's a future in the arts in this country because, you know, even though it's been a really tough few years funding-wise, artists are so strong, and when they're passionate about what they're creating and what their art delivers, you know, to society, they will find a way.
Flautist Tamara Kohler, Sarah White with that report. And that's PM for this week. PM's supervising producer is David Cody, technical production by Alan Arthur and Mark Cash. Good night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hey, Brett Worthington here from the ABC's Parliament House Bureau. Voting can be confusing. Who knows who half the people are on the ballot paper? To make it easier, we've got a tool that will allow you to do your homework before you get to the polling booth. You can generate your own test ballot to take along so you don't vote for someone you really don't want to. Forget who the parties want you to preference and take control of your vote. To have a go, head to the Australia Votes website at abc.net.au/AustraliaVotes.